workshop because the coherence will come up, but only partially. So this has been work done at the University of Queensland. I'm associated with Centre for Quantum Computer Technology, funded by the Normal Suspects Australia and US government. In the next 35-40 minutes, I'll take you through what I mean by optical entangling gates, and we'll look at three examples: a Fock state filter, some quantum logic, and then some time reversal. This is mostly experiment. There's a little bit of theory there, just enough that I feel dirty. Yeah, that's right. Okay, let's just do an ad for a minute. I have a lab called the Quantum Technology Lab. We have experiments in quantum schmonum. Just in case people haven't visited, Brisbane's down here. We're up here at the moment, but feel free. It's not as far as it looks, honestly. It is when it's light here. Okay, to the people who do the work, a bunch of students have been involved in the work you're about to see. In particular, Till Weinhold and Robert Prevettel. There's a bunch of postdocs and staff who've been involved with aspects of it. This is to say we've got two new postdocs coming, and there's still one position being advertised. And if you know of anyone, please let me know. And a bunch of external collaborators, including Daniel James here at the University of Toronto. I really want to highlight Kevin Resch, who's been the driver for the three experiments you're going to see today. He's a University of Toronto graduate, and I'm happy for Kevin to say, and sad for Australia to say, that he's coming back to Canada in 2.5 weeks and setting up a new group at the University of Waterloo. So visit him there. Okay, introduction. So we are doing optical experiments. We need photons. Our photon source is something called spontaneous parametric downconversion. You take a high-energy laser beam, pass it through a nonlinear optical crystal, and every now and then the photon splits into a pair of lower-energy photons, conserving energy and momentum. The state can be written out as this, where epsilon is a very small number between, say, 10 to the minus 5 and 10 to the minus 7. And every now and then, even smaller amount of time, there's two pairs of photons at once. We'll come back to that because that's important. But nevertheless, if I get a click at this detector, then I can condition and know that there's one and only one photon in the other mode with a fairly high probability, although, as I point out, there's some higher order terms as well. These sources are well understood in how they behave spatially. You can kind of change the shapes and propagate them into single-mode fibers. And for people who were at the conference last week, you heard Paul Quiert talk about how they're getting brighter and brighter with time. Okay, so that's kind of the background. We want to make single qubits. That's a two-level system, a quantum system that has some coherence. Polarization is the kind of canonical encoding. But I'll point out photons are very simple systems, but there's still a number of degrees of freedom that people can use. Spatial encoding is used, path encoding, temporal encoding, and frequency encoding. There's a group in ADFRA in Canberra in Australia who have started playing with that. And no matter what you choose, you need to be able to make a coherent superposition of your two levels to use it as a qubit. We're using polarization for most of our things because polarization is so very easily manipulated. A Hadamard gate is a single wave plate. An arbitrary single qubit unitary is three wave plates. Okay, the trick, of course, comes in making a two-qubit gate. That requires a massive nonlinearity. I think the earliest paper that I'm aware of talking about this was one by Jerry Milburn back in 88. But it can't be done with conventional classical nonlinear optics. And in fact, it can't even really be done with cavity QED systems. At least I'm not aware of any nice demonstration that's very efficient. So you can do it, however, with so-called measurement-induced nonlinearity. So this is Manny Nil, Ray Lafemme, Jared Milburn. They had this nice paper that said basically if you take some optical qubits, pass it through a linear optical network, you can make it look like... it can be. Has it done? Been done? It can be done, but I'm not aware of any nice demonstrations. In principle, you build a nice system, but... even in the cavity QED demonstration by Kimball's group, it was non-deterministic and worked something like 12% of the time. Okay. Please do it. Actually, I'll have a comment on that in a minute. Okay. To make this work, you need some additional single photons, often called ancilla photons, single photon detection and fast feed forward. Jared's recently just been looking at generalizing that to what if you've got arbitrary numbers of photons here and do arbitrary detections of numbers of photons here? In general, what condition states and processes are possible? One thing to notice is that's the old photo. He's a lot happier now, but he's still got the same t-shirt after 5 years. So. And who said physicists weren't fashionable? All right, so let's look at an application of that, a Fock state filter. I thought they had to talk on Fock state since the acronym for the conference was FOCT, which I thought was very nice. And this comes back to your comment, Ben Snipshoot, or whatever his name is, a computer scientist from Caltech, and he said, in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice, but in practice, there is. So the next little bit of the talk is going to be about the practice, not the theory. Okay, so consider a beam splitter with one photon coming in this port and n photons coming in the top port, and consider the case now where you find afterwards one photon in the bottom port. How can that happen? Well, one way it can happen is that everything reflects, and that has an amplitude of root r n to the plus 1, where r is the reflectivity of the beam splitter, or there are n ways where a photon from each beam can get transmitted and everything else reflects, and when you add those amplitudes together, you get a term that looks like this, and you can see that there will be certain values for the reflectivity and the number of photons coming in where this can go to zero. Okay? That's non-classical interference in optics. In particular, that the reflectivity has a value of m divided by m plus 1, where m is a certain number of photons, then the probability of getting m photons reflected up here when you detect a single photon below is zero and non-zero for everything else, and you've made a Fock state filter. It'll notch out certain Fock states. An example would be, say, you had a number superposition like this, you send it through the Fock state filter, it might knock out just a single photon term. Okay? That's a very simple concept. Experimentally, it's less so. Making these things with good efficiency is onerous. This is a terrible beam to send anywhere because if you lose a single photon, it completely changes the superposition. The Fock state filter, as sketched out here, requires a perfect single photon source and photon number resolving detectors, and that's difficult to do. And then to see that you've done this, you'd need very good homodyne tomography. So I'm going to show you in two slides a kind of a shortcut way to check whether such a thing works based on non-classical interference. Given all these difficulties, by the way, we started thinking of this as fucking around with non-classical interference. That was for Ephraim. So the way around it is you make the superposition across two modes. So initially send, say, two photons in the horizontal mode in a single spatial path, and then pass that through a wave plate, and then what ends up afterwards is a superposition across those two modes. So if you look, for example, only at the vertical mode, you have a superposition of 0, 1, and 2 photons. So we did our experiment as follows. These are outputs from a down converter, and we're using the higher order term. So there's two photons here and here. We know there's two photons there and there because eventually we have four detectors, and we only look at coincidence counts where we get four clicks. We make our ancilla by getting a single click here, and then we know, because this is a polarizing beam splitter, that the remaining photon here, which will later be detected, is horizontally polarized. We make our superposition here by polarizing the output to be horizontal, then sending it through a wave plate. The coincidence now gets rid of the loss effects, because if a photon is lost from the superposition, we won't end up with four photons here and we won't see it, so it doesn't degrade our signal. The Fock state filter then is just the beam splitter detector as shown. Afterwards, we have, at least in principle, the filtered state where the 1-1 term's been removed. And then if you send that through, that's still difficult to measure, but if you send it through a 50-50 beam splitter, after the beam splitter, if you have a photon in each path, they're either both horizontal or both vertical, and that's a polarization entangled state, and you can just measure that with quantum state tomography. So that gets rid of all the difficulties for testing the system. This is a measurement of this side here is 2-photon and this side is 4-photon coincidences as you delay the non-classical interference. Ideally, this should be 100% because that's representing the 1-1 photon term or the single photon term. We measure 95% and then there's some higher order background here which you can correct for, and then that would be 99.6%. The 4-photon terms ideally should have a visibility of 2/3. We measure close to that. And if you just look at zero delay, what you're wanting to see here is this represents the single photon terms in that reflected beam, and this the 2-photon terms. And the single photons are preferentially absorbed at about 60 times the rate of the photon pairs. So that's a filter, but is it a coherent filter? And you can't really tell from that measurement. What you need to do is look at the coherence information. And so the way to do that is look at the outputs via tomography, as we described earlier. Say you sent in a pair of diagonally polarized photons in the two-photon term at the top that I showed previously. With the filter off, the output would just look like this. You'd just get a pair of diagonally polarized photons out. That's ideally what we measure, looks a lot like that. The fidelity is close to one. The entropy is not quite zero. There's a little bit of mixture, just even in our state preparation, and the tangle zero to within error. Then when you turn the filter on, what you would expect is you'd knock out these two terms here and retain the strong coherences. What we measure at first looks quite a bit like that, but then if you look at it a little bit more carefully, the fidelity is quite a bit down from what it was, and the reason for that is it's only partially coherent. 100% entropy would be fully incoherent, 0% or 11% would be as close to pure as we can make in the lab, and consequently the tangle is reduced as well. And if you get into it a little bit, the reason this is so low is there's quite a little bit of population here still. And if you ask how well is the filter working given those populations, it's only working at about a factor of 6 suppression. So what's going on? Where is this decoherence coming from? And why is the system not acting ideally? So I'm going to answer that indirectly by moving on to the next topic, which is where we really started getting into this issue properly, which is building a 2-qubit gate or a quantum logic gate. So remember, we're still dealing with this linear optical network, some arbitrary number of photons coming in here and some measurement. In the original KLM proposal, it was realized, of course, that these gates aren't deterministic, but you get a success signal when they work, so you can combine them with teleportation in the following way. So here I've got a control qubit and a pair of entangled photons. I do a joint measurement, a Bell measurement between, say, the control qubit and this photon. I get two pieces of information, I feed that forward, and then that teleports this state to here. And that seems to be a lot of work, given that you can just shine a photon across the room and it'll get there as well. But I can do that with a control and target photon, and now I can take this circuit and embed it between the two. And it works in the following way now, at least in principle. I bring my control and target photons into my perfect quantum memory that I bought at Walmart. I'd have many pairs of entangled photons, and I run it continuously through the gate until I get a success signal. When I get the success signal, I let these photons go, I pull these out of memory, do the Bell measurements, feed forward, and that teleports the action of the gate. So, at first, there's been a lot of different proposals on how to make these non-deterministic gates. They kind of fall into two categories. There's ones where the ancilla photons are essential for the quantum logic to operate. The original KLM proposal was like that. There's been a bunch of other proposals since then. And there's ones where the quantum logic you can do separately to the action of seeing if there's a single photon here. A proposal by our group and also in Japan. And then you could do a QND measurement, at least in principle, with a single photon detectors and linear optics as well. That's a proposal by Cockley and Dowling. Since we're working in coincidence, we don't need to do this. Because we'll only get signals when we get a photon at each detector, and that lets us just concentrate on the quantum logic in the gate and look at the decoherence just of that process without worrying about additional sources of decoherence. There's been a bunch of experimental work. Oh, now, you take any of these things and add teleportation and add error correction, and then in principle you have scalable quantum computation. There's been a bunch of experimental work on this, mostly by Anton Zeilinger's group in Austria and Jim Franson's group in the US. But for the next few slides, I'm just going to concentrate on these simplified two-photon gates. They work as follows. This is dual-rail notation for people who aren't familiar with it. C0 and C1 just represent the two possible states of a control qubit, and similarly for a target qubit. If a pi phase shift occurs when the control is in the logical one state, and it puts, say, a pi on the logical target state, then that's a controlled sine gate. Ideally, a nonlinearity would do that. Perhaps EIT, but that's very difficult. And the reason C sine is interesting, one of the reasons is if you add Hadamards to it, you just end up with the better known controlled NOT gate. So an alternative to this is you just add 3 1/3 beam splitters into the circuit. Now consider two photons as shown here. if they both end up in these modes after passing the beam splitters, the only way that can happen is if they both reflect. And so the amplitude for that is 1/3 of the initial state. That's classical optics. It's not very interesting. But now, when we let the two photons interact, as before, we now end up with a non-classical interference, again, conditioned on the two photons both ending up in these modes over here. There's two possible ways that could have happened. They both could have transmitted through the beam splitter, and that has 1 minus eta amplitude, or both reflected eta. If the beam splitter was eta equals 1/2, these two would completely cancel, and that would be the Hongo-Mandel non-classical interference, which was the first one discovered. But in our case, eta equals 1/3, and we see that we have 1/3 of the amplitude, but now with a negative sign shift. And that's the action of the controlled sign gate that we're after. You can map from, say, polarization into this dual spatial rail with polarizing beam splitters and, for example, wave plates, and that would make a controlled not gate. But we would never do that in practice because each of these interferometers would have to be locked and they would also have to be phase locked to one another, and that would be a lot of work. So a way around that is, if you look at this circuit, this 1/3 interference doesn't have to happen at the same time as the 1/3 reflectivities over here. So we can use a partially polarizing beam splitter that's reflective for horizontal polarization, for example, and not for vertical. Bring our two photons in at that, the non-classical interference just occurs there, and then add wave plates and two more of these beam splitters to separately do the 1/3 reflectances for the other arms, and that then becomes a controlled sign or controlled not gate, depending on how you set it up. The advantage of that is there's no dual path interferometer, so there's nothing to lock, and there's no mode mismatch due to having dual path interferometers. The disadvantage is if the manufacturer lies to you about their tolerances, you've got no adjustment. But that's life. Okay, how do you know if this system works? As before, you need to do tomography. If the system makes entangled states, then, okay, it's some kind of entangling gate. State tomography, you do combinations of the basis states. So if horizontal and vertical are logical 0 and 1, you take various combinations of 0, 1, 0 plus 1, 0 plus I, 1. And in general, for n qubits, you need 2 to the 2n measurements. But that's really not enough. Even if your system makes entangled states, it doesn't prove or give you a measure of what kind of entangling gate it is. What you really need to do is process tomography. And in the same way that we have basis states, we have basis processes, which are just rotations on the Poincaré sphere. And again, we can take combinations of those. And in general, you need 2 to the 4n measurements. So for people at the conference last week, there was some discussions on, you know, when is this necessary? How quickly does it grow? And it grows very badly. You know, it's exponential. And I'll just point out that the reconstructed, if you apply the kind of naive recipes for either of these, what you reconstruct is not physical, and you need to take into account the effects of uncertainties. And there's work by a number of groups, including Ephraim Steinberg's group here at Toronto, on how to handle that. Some kind of technique, either maximum likelihood or listening to Robin Bloom-Cahoot, Bayesian analysis is required to make that physical. Okay, so for a controlled sign gate, the perfect unitary is this, so that is some of the time do nothing to the control on the target, some of the time do nothing to the control, sigma z on the target, and so on. In the same way that a density matrix is a table of state measurement outcomes and the coherences between them, you can do a chi matrix, which is a table of process measurement outcomes and the coherences between them. The chi matrix for an ideal controlled sign gate might look like this. The diagonal is here, II, IZ, ZI, ZZ, and the rest of the coherences. We measure that. Oh, sorry, that's ideal. We measure that. They look very similar. And now you want to start being able to quantify how well have you done in the lab. You could just take the overlap, the fidelity between those two things, but it's not physical. It's not a metric, and it doesn't correspond to anything physical. So what people tend to cite is something like the average gate fidelity. If you send in an infinite number of possible input states, what would be the average fidelity of all the output states that you measured with the input states? That can be calculated longhand, but the easy way is just take the process fidelity, times it by the dimension of the system, add it by 1, and normalize it, and that gives you the average gate fidelity. And for this system, the average gate fidelity is shade under 90%. For an older experiment, it was 94%. The larger error bar there was because we had a less evolved error analysis technique. Okay. So that's starting to look very promising. So where do we go from here? Well, where we go from here is I have to admit that I lied to you earlier. When I drew this up and said you take this and you embed it in the teleporter and you can make non-deterministic gates deterministic. But for people in quantum optics, that you knew that was a lie. The Bell state measurement requires an entangling gate. And if you had an entangling gate that could do a Bell state measurement, you wouldn't be trying to build an entangling gate. So, in fact, there's a proof that shows in a single degree of freedom, the best you can do for a Bell state measurement is it'll work half the time, which means the best that this teleporter will work is one quarter of the time. Okay, that doesn't look terribly useful. You don't want a broken teleporter because that leads to issues, as we all know. So what's the way around it? Well, the way around it, this was recognized by KLM in their initial paper, it must be said. And if you wade through that paper, which has been described, I think, fairly as the best paper you'll never read, it was in two parts. You increase the entangled resources you need in the teleporter, and then you concatenate the physical gates to form a logical gate. So an example of the first is you have a more complicated path entangled state. You run the non-deterministic gate between just two of the paths of that. You have a more complicated measurement system in feed forward, and that will work 4/9 of the time as opposed to 1/4. That's the so-called level 1 encoding. Level 2 works 9/16 of the time and so on. And then if you wanted to build a gate that works, say, 95% of the time, you would need 300, not even of these, but of the level 2 encoded gates, each working 9/16 of the time. That ends up being tens of thousands of optical elements and resources, and so that's, frankly, fairly horrifying. And in general, you need an infinite number of modes to get to perfect efficiency. When I talked about this in Taiwan about 18 months ago, the only question I got at the end was, is she in your research group? And I could honestly answer no, but I am very sure that if I got into the shower with any of my students, they'd scream like that. So, all right. What's the way around this? Because that doesn't look very promising. Remember, in conventional quantum circuits, you have unitaries, you have entangling gates, which are these red lines here, and if each one of those needs tens of thousands of optical elements just to get the 95%, that's not a very optimistic picture. The solution is something called graph state computation, or sometimes one-way quantum computing. And now the circles represent qubits, and the red lines represent entanglement between the qubits. The most common graph states are something called a cluster state. And there are a lot of theory papers showing you get down to only needing 10 to 100 optical elements, number of resources, and ancilla states, depending on how you want to count things, for a two-qubit gate. And so plotting with time, there's been a number of proposals, we've gone from needing 10,000 gate resources to 10 to 100 gate resources. This is a log linear plot. I'm an experimentalist. So by about 2008, we should be able to do things with less than one physical gate, which would be great. In case the theorists don't do their job, though, we should probably still play a little bit here. So how do you build a cluster state? It's fine to write it down. Well, it turns out that the entangled pair we were making earlier is a two-photon cluster, and this was the circuit for doing it. And if you add one more photon and one more beam splitter, you can build a three-photon cluster. And in general, this is a repeat unit and will let you make an n-photon cluster, although it must be said with decreasing probability. So we want to do that, but more or less compulsory experimental picture here. This is not miniaturized, obviously, at the moment. The laser beams are here. The beam splitters are shown in green. And we have a third photon beam we can bring in, and that's kind of the repeat unit. So we started doing that and then realized we should really dot our I's and cross our T's and vary the input conditions even to just the normal gate. So what do I mean? Well, up until now, the gate had been tested by taking a down conversion pair and using both photons from the pair and sending it through the gate. And remember, that gave us an average gate fidelity of about 90%, just under 90%. That's not fair, though, because there's a lot of symmetry in this situation, and it might be that you've got sources of decoherence that you're cancelling out, and we really want to know how it would work when that's not true. So what you can do is you can take, say, two independent down conversion sources here. There's one in the forward direction and one in the backwards direction. Trigger off of photons here, and that makes independent photons, which you then send through the gate. And when we did that, the gate fidelity dropped to 81%. Okay, that is given the error bars, that 8% drop is significant. The non-classical interference is still 94% of what it should be, and we think that 6% difference is mostly due to mode mismatch. So what's going on? What's leading to this significant drop in fidelity? Okay. We rotated, by the way, this average gate fidelity has been checked by first numerically rotating it to make sure that you've got no extra unitaries in the outputs. So we're sure that anything that leads to a decrease in this is due to decoherence. So to check this, the only thing that was different physically was the source. The experiment was set up with fibers that weren't moved, so we only just unplugged the fibers from one source and plugged them into another. So to figure out what was going on, we made a model first on the measured reflectivities in the gate and accounting for higher order down conversion. And what do I mean by that? Well, it's what we were doing before. So sometimes here we've got, say, one forward pair and one backwards pair of photons, but also some different fraction of the time, two pairs of backwards, one forward, or one pair backwards and two pairs forward. The model's very simple. It assumes the photons are perfectly indistinguishable, which we know they're not in the lab, but it's close enough. And we found something interesting, which had you asked me certainly 10 months ago, I would have just disagreed with you. We found that it makes an important difference. So, for example, if I send in a logical 0 and 1 to a C-sign gate, there's no classical interference. That's ideally, this will come out of the gate. But our model predicts now, with a very small amount of higher order photon terms, but remember, we're talking fractions of a percent, that the fidelity between what you would ideally like and what you will get is going to be 88%. And in fact, that's what we measured as well. And this difference in 12% in the output state fidelity is entirely due to the photon source, these very tiny amounts of photon terms. And a hand-wavy picture to see this is, although there's only a very small probability of these extra photons coming in, the gate is also only working non-deterministically. So it's also got a very small probability, and it's biased by these higher order terms coming in and have more chance of surviving the gate, coming through and looking like noise. It gets worse if you then go to a situation where you know there's going to be non-classical interference. So for example, if you send in a superposition in the control and target, D here stands for H plus V or 0 plus 1. Our model predicts that you'll take an 18% hit due to the source, and what we measure is a 74% hit, which is roughly consistent. This extra 8% is on the order of the mode mismatch we'd measured in this experiment and previous ones. So you grit your teeth. Measuring states is not measuring a gate. Ideal, remember that was the ideal gate tomography. Our model now predicts that you're going to take a nearly 30% hit in operation just due to these small extra photon terms. And what we measure, these are early numbers, which is why there's no error bars, but they're going to be on the order of a few percent because of the low count rates. What we measure is roughly consistent with that. And I guess the take-home lesson from this is decoherence is also due to photon sources as well as mode mismatch. Now, we had already known in the field that photon sources were going to be important and that the closer you get to a true single photon source, the better things will be. But until this, I hadn't appreciated just what a deleterious effect they were going to have. Mode mismatch, there's a well-known technical path to move along to get that down, and that's been done by the traditional photonics industry. So if you look at the kind of things in telecommunications, they've got mode mismatch down to the order of 0.1 to 1% at worst. So I'm confident there's a path for this. This, however, just, you know, that's where active research is going on at different groups around the world, and that's becoming very, very important now for this field. Okay, in my remaining 10 minutes or so, I'll just switch gears now a little bit and go back to, it's called time reversal, but really we're coming back to this issue of linear optical networks where, again, we can send in some number of photons and measure some number here, and what condition states and processes are possible. We already heard at the conference last week about making noon states. This is an entangled state. Since I'm from quantum information, I just think of this as an entangled state of qubits. I've got n qubits in the logical zero state and none in the other, or n qubits in the logical one state and none in the other. And then depending what field you're from, if the qubits are spin qubits, you call it a Schrodinger cat. If they're polarization qubits, you call it a G8Z state. Or if it's a path number entanglement, you call it a noon state. It's all the same kind of thing. And they all have the same kind of properties. And this was pointed out, and we've got Morgan Mitchell and Ephraim Steinberg here in a paper from the University of Toronto. There's two properties that are relevant. So phase superresolution, this is where you get n fringes in the space where you'd normally get one fringe. So the effective wavelength is lambda divided by n, where n is the number of qubits. And phase supersensitivity, the best phase you can measure with a classical light beam goes as 1 on root n, where n is the number of quanta, but with this kind of state, you can get a phase sensitivity on 1 and n. And there are other quantum states that share this property, for example, squeezing. What isn't commonly appreciated is phase superresolution implies phase supersensitivity only if there's a certain criteria met, which is the visibility of the fringes that you observe here squared times the efficiency with which you gather the light times the number of qubits is greater than or equal to 1. So we'll see what that means in a slide or two. It should be pointed out noon states have been made in a number of systems. Dave Wineland's group have made it with ions in a deterministic fashion. They've certainly measured phase superresolution with good visibilities. Remember, the criteria is this. If you think about it, that means that you need to beat the visibility needs to be higher than these numbers here. And they may have done phase supersensitivity, but we can't tell from their paper. If their efficiencies that they gather the light, or that they gather the information about the ions was greater than that, then they certainly did see phase supersensitivity. Okay, what about in optics? Well, as we've already heard, making entangling states with light is difficult, but you can do it non-deterministically. I think the earliest proposal to do it non-deterministically was by Koch et al. I'm going to give you a slightly simpler version here, which is you take n single photons, send them through a multiport, which is just think of it as a complicated interferometer that has n output ports. And in the situation where you measure in these n-2 output ports, you see no photons, then you know that there's n photons in these remaining two modes, and in fact, they must be in a noon state, and that occurs with probability eta. Okay, so this is kind of a projection by no measurement, which makes experimentalists nervous, but it's fine theoretically. And then you do a deterministic measurement to see what your noon state looks like. You want that measurement to have good, kappa here is overlap, you want it to have good overlap with a noon state, and in the case where it is non-zero, then the probability you get goes as eta, which is the generation efficiency, times the overlap kappa, times this 1 plus cosine of n phi, and that gives you the phase super resolution. The measurements can be, for example, measure n photons and zero photons where you've wiped out the which path information, or it can be do homodyne on both paths, doesn't really matter. The best known efficiencies for these non-deterministic schemes for making noon states goes as 2n factorial divided by n to the n minus 1, which isn't going to scale well with n, you can see. And if you apply it to this criteria, you'll see that you'll only ever get phase supersensitivity with these non-deterministic schemes for 2 or 3 photons. Okay. So there's been a couple of tour de force experiments done. One here at Toronto, where they created a GHZ signal beam using a technique called mode mashing, and then measured the phase on that signal beam. They got beautiful phase super resolution signals. In the case where n equals 3, they were getting a 5 hertz signal, so 5 times a second they were seeing that. Phase super sensitivity, in principle, if their efficiency was 1 and their visibility was better, they could have, but they didn't, but that's fine. That wasn't the point of the experiment. There was an alternative experiment from Anton Zeilinger's group in Austria. This was a slightly weirder one, where they had a UV pump beam came in, generated 4 photons non-deterministically, then used that in a non-deterministic circuit, and measured the phase on the pump beam. Okay, doing that, they got a very messy phase super resolution signal, but you know, if you stand back and squint, you can see 4 fringes there. But just in principle, you'll never get phase supersensitivity in that scheme. So a lot of people publish papers on quantum metrology, and they often talk about phase superresolution as if it's the be-all and end-all of quantum metrology, and of course it's not. But if you're after phase superresolution, there are alternative ways to do it. So for example, and this is where the time reversal comes in, there's a paper by Pregnell and Pegg from a couple of years ago saying you can always construct a linear optical device which will non-deterministically measure any target state given any input state. Okay, it may be that the overlap between them is zero, but okay, in principle it can be done. So for example, if you're wanting to measure a noon state as opposed to create a noon state, this says you can find a way to do it, and I'll walk you through an example. Say before we had n single photons here, they're kind of difficult to make, and then you need to do a measurement, which we looked at and they were kind of difficult. But you could time reverse it and do deterministic preparation, send those two modes through the same kind of optical interferometer, and now you're sending in n-2 vacuum modes, and they're experimentalists really like those because they're available everywhere with perfect fidelity, and then count just n single photons, which you can do in coincidence, and that somehow looks like an easier thing to do experimentally. We said before, and in both cases, by the way, these are projected measurements that are independent of the input state. Right? You're always projecting onto the same kind of thing. It may be that you project with zero probability. Earlier I said we could count n photons and count zero photons. Well, the time reversal of that is producing n and zero photons. That's difficult. But I also said you can do homodyne in each arm. And the time reversal of that is just a coherent state. And that's kind of easy. You can get that from a laser. So now you're looking at an experiment that involves just a laser, vacuum inputs, and single photon counting in coincidence, and that's somehow easier to do. So it says at least in principle you can measure a noon state with a normal laser and photon counters as opposed to produce a noon state. All right. How do you make the multiport? Well, there's a theory paper from a long time ago saying you can always make a multiport with n inputs in and n outputs out just using normal beam splitters. So this is an example of how you do it for a so-called, they're called 2n ports, where n is the number of inputs. So this would be a 6-port. Experimentally, we now made the two coherent modes that we were sending in two different polarizations of the one laser, and we induced the phase shift between them with wave plates. This interferometer here, we realized with calcite beam displacers, and we could tune these beam splitters to have the appropriate values using wave plates as shown. And then doing that, the coincidence signal, when we counted three photons here, looked as follows. The single signals look like that. And if you take three sine waves, multiply them together and just do a fit, this is the fit that you get. The reduced chi-squared is kind of good. And then if you take the sine waves that this function predicts and overlay them on what you measure for the singles rates, you get a very nice agreement between what you see and what you would expect you would see given this. Well, what do you tell from that? Well, I think the most important take-home lesson is this is classical. And by that I mean seeing the phase super resolution can be done with a kind of classical system. In fact, we ran our experiment in a regime where technically we weren't quite projecting onto a noon state but something else. But in this regime, coincidence counting is just the same as doing counting with normal detectors and doing signal multiplication. Okay? In the absence of non-classical interference, and there's clearly no non-classical interference here, coincidence counting just equals signal multiplication. Just for experimental pornography, we also did a high noon state where n equals 6, slightly different circuit, more complicated. The error bars are about this long if you can't see them at the back. More complicated pattern. Again, doing just a fit of 6 sine waves, a multiple of 6 sine waves. We now get a reduced chi-squared of 1.7. It's a little bit messier. But again, take the predicted singles waves from this and overlay them on the experiment, and it matches very well. Okay. So this time reversal, I just bring it to your attention as it's kind of a fun thing to play around with. It isn't really a way we'd been thinking about experiments. This is one of those rare cases where the easiest thing to do was probably better if all you're after was phase super resolution. Okay? If you're trying to make noon states, this is not at all sensible. All you're doing is measuring them. But if you're trying to see phase super resolution, then you get, you know, good visibility at a fair production rate and a high number of fringes. Entangled states are not necessary. We've been having a 6-month argument with a referee on we think entangled measurement suffices, but if you stand back and blur your eyes about what you mean about entanglement, it may be that just measurement suffices. It's certainly true that to get super phase resolution, you can completely do that with classical interference. Okay, but that's not the point of this. It's about this time reversal. So that actually brings me pretty nicely to my concluding questions. I don't have any concluding valuable statements for you. I'd just like to leave you with three questions that I'd like to know the answer to. In general, what conditioned states and processes are possible with linear optics and measurement? We're starting to explore the space, but I don't think we've got final answers at all. What are the sources of decoherence in these systems? Okay, mode match was an obvious one, and one we'd, or mismatch, and one we've been dealing with. But the tremendously strong effect of higher order photon terms we were not expecting. And then finally, when and how do you need entanglement in some of these quantum information protocols? And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention.